Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Good afternoon, this is Richard Martin here with your Thursday regular dose of Richard Martin's wake-up call, coming to you from a very cloudy Miami today. Often I reflect, as I'm sure they did in the 30s, on the incredible amount of speculation and the frenzy that went on that has been always associated with crowds in times past. And I came across an article in Newsweek just a few days ago, and it was called The Impulsive Deciders, and it was discussing whether people are actually hardwired to make bad choices. Because after all, you know, we all know, at least we think we know, when we're choosing something which is patently bad for us and hopefully avoiding such a choice. But there are apparently neurological reasons that these consumers have fallen into these risky financial traps, like adjustable rate mortgages. And it talks about the region of the midbrain called the ventral striatum, which may be partly to blame for the fact that millions of people fell prey to the risky financial gambles like adjustable rate mortgages. And obviously this has been going on since the early 1980s, when the lenders were luring prospective borrowers with these complicated loan agreements with low teaser interest rates, which of course inflate dramatically years down the line. And there's a new study, according to this article, which appeared this week in the journal Neuron, offering some insight into what many of us were thinking or not thinking when we signed along the dotted line. And it turns out that in some cases, our brains are wired to fall into these kind of financial traps. Scott Hüttel, who's the Duke cognitive neuroscientist, says that when making risky financial decisions, and I quote, "we do not consider all of the potential probabilities, benefits, and costs. Instead, our brains seek out a way to simplify these complex problems. Oversimplifying, however, may go against the most rational choice." And that's according to Baba Sheaf, a marketing professor at Stanford's Business School. For instance, we may shop for mortgages based solely on finding the best introductory rate and then be vulnerable to exorbitant reset rates and the other hidden fees down the road. So, anyway, Scott Hüttel and his colleagues identified patterns of brain activation to predict who among us is likely to make these simplifications. Subjects were presented with a lottery offering five outcomes ranging from winning $80 to losing $80. Two outcomes paid out money, two lost money, and one was neutral. Subjects were given a chance to add $20 to one of the outcomes. Standard economic models argue that people hedge against big losses, and the study participants would act to minimize the amount of money they would lose by adding money to the losing option and maximize their winnings by adding money to the highest payout. However, 70% of the time, the nearly 200 study participants elected to add $20 to the neutral middle outcome, that's the one with no payout or penalty. They chose this simplifying strategy, says Hüttel, because doing that, and I quote, altered the overall odds of winning so that there were now more good outcomes, 3, than bad outcomes, only 2. When the subjects played multiple rounds of this lottery while having their brains scanned with functional magnetic resonance imaging, the researchers observed differences between participants who were most likely to approach the problem by upping the odds of winning and those who chose to mitigate monetary loss, as would be more logical if you considered all the options. Those who decided to up the odds of winning rather than mitigating any potential losses showed more activation in the ventral striatum when they won or lost money as compared to their economically savvier counterparts. This means they were more sensitive in that win-lose region of the brain, but less able to do the complex decision-making that would be required to mitigate the loss. Who are these less financially savvy decision-makers? According to Stanford's Sheev, prior research shows that people with increased sensitivity in their ventral striatum are often extroverted. They tend to be more impulsive, he says. They also tend to be more optimistic. So when confronted with an adjustable rate mortgage, they simplify the situation and might play down the probability of misfortune in the long term, such as losing their job and not being able to make payments, or a tanking housing market that would make it impossible to refinance. In the past, however, these optimistic simplifiers would have been better off because mortgages and even credit card rules were simpler, says Richard Thaler, a behavioral economist at the University of Chicago and co-author of Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. In the late 70s, early 80s, when the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage was pretty much the only loan option, a rule of thumb worked well. You looked for one number, the annual percentage rate, decided if you could afford it, and then signed on the dotted line or walked away. Once mortgages got very, very complicated, says Thaler, doing the correct analysis required having a PhD in economics, and simplifying under those circumstances became dangerous. Even with the new consumer protections, financial products remain complex. So how do impulsive consumers protect themselves from falling for the tricks and traps in the lending game? Thaler suggests choosing a simple 30-year mortgage. And he says that the government could help make things easier by requiring lending institutions to offer the 20 or so pages of disclosure in a mortgage agreement available in a machine-readable form, such as a spreadsheet, so that the terms could be compared easily with other mortgage types. In fact, the Credit Card Bill of Rights Act of 2009, which President Obama signed into law this month, moves in that direction, forcing credit card companies to place their agreements online. Such a requirement would allow a third-party website to go into the business of giving mortgage advice to consumers, says Thaler. A site called BillShrink.com, for example, offers counsel on credit card agreements, as well as advising consumers on which of the increasingly complicated mobile phone plans is best for them. But what if you aren't interested in a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage and can't wait for the government to require that those mortgages be put online for easy analysis? Sheev suggests bringing a friend or partner to the lender's office to play devil's advocate. By questioning your whims, they may just block your midbrain from mortgaging your future. Well, that's nice and interesting. A bit late, though, I would say. It would be nice if they'd written that article, say, 5 years ago. It's all about bolting the barn after the horse, you know, locking the barn after the horse has bolted. Right, this is Richard Martin, Richard Martin's wake-up call. My toll-free number for you to call in and ask questions is 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. If you'd like to email your questions, we've got a lot of mail today to get through, including, unfortunately, some that I don't have time to read. So that is clearly the preferred mode of communication. So So please feel free to send your emails in to rmartin@latam.inv.com. LatamInv is LATAMINV, Latin American Investments, LatamInv, run small. rmartin@lataminv.com. And if you want to call me directly to discuss your financial situation, you will receive a sympathetic ear by calling my direct line at 305-579-2012. Once again, my direct line for personal questions about economic problems is 305-579-2012. Okay. Well, I've quoted this passage from John Kenneth Galbraith's 1954 book, The Great Crash, 1929, many times, and actually a couple of times already on this show, but you really can't read it too often. It describes how the principle of maximum ruin played out in 1929, and I will read it again. A common feature of all these earlier troubles, previous panics, was that having happened, they were over. The worst was reasonably recognizable as such. The singular feature of the Great Crash of 1929 was that the worst continued to worsen. What looked one day like the end proved on the next day to have been only the beginning. Nothing could have been more ingeniously designed to maximize the suffering and also to ensure that as few as possible escaped the common misfortune. The fortunate speculator who had funds to answer the first margin call presently got another, an equally urgent one. And if he met that, there would be still another. In the end, all the money he had was extracted from him and lost. The man with the smart money, who was safely out of the market when the first crash came, naturally went back in to pick up the bargains. The bargains then suffered a ruinous fall. Even the man who waited out all of October and all of November, who saw the volume of trading return to normal and saw Wall Street become as placid as a produce market, and who then bought common stocks, would see their value drop to a third or fourth of the purchase price in the next 24 months. The ruthlessness of the stock market was remarkable. And that comes from page 108 of John Kenneth Galbraith's 1954 book, The Great Crash, 1929. It is really a stunning book, absolutely riveting, quite as effective as any black and white movie of the period, or even subsequent to that period, looking back. And frankly, anyone who listens to the CNBC pundits is going to learn for himself how ruthless the stock market is, just as people did after the 1929 crash. And there's any amount of evidence out there, ladies and gentlemen, to prove to you that what we've been seeing in this recent run-up in the market is nothing more than a bear market rally. And those people who have 10, 15, 20, 25% profit on their positions, sadly, are going to see them all melt away, and they won't know what's hit them. This is a classic long-term bear market we are in, a market which goes down two steps and up one. And woe betide anybody who's caught on the wrong side of this thing. It will be very, very unpleasant indeed. Well, frankly, when you see how the Federal Reserve is issuing money and trying to goose the system for all it's worth, all it takes is the understanding that there simply isn't enough capital in the world to buy all this new sovereign issuance that is required to finance the giant fiscal deficits that countries are now so intent on running. There just isn't enough money out there. And all this giddy talk of green shoots has completely drowned out a more sober and rational assessment of the global situation. Sort of random statistical noise in various minor economic indicators have had the effect over the last couple of months in wild exclamations of phrases like, the worst is definitely over. Well, I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it most certainly is not. With every major economy in the world attempting to solve this economic crisis with both loose monetary and fiscal policy, it was only a matter of time before the global credit markets would reach their limits. And these limits have almost been reached. The long end of every curve of every major economy has been steadily climbing. The rate of change has now accelerated, and interest rates on these important benchmarks have now reached pre-crisis levels. In a zero interest rate policy world, this is definitely a bad sign. It is very, very tragic to see how these formerly respectable governments from the US to the UK have gone on the sort of banana republic route and started monetizing their debts in a desperate effort to prevent long-term rates from rising, which is having no effect. Long-term rates are soaring as I speak, ladies and gentlemen. A veritable tsunami of debt issuance now sits just over the horizon, waiting to be dumped on this crippled and saturated global debt market. The UK saw its debt rating reduced to negative watch last week, and it will eventually lose its triple A rating, and the US, frankly, cannot be far behind. These rising rates will drag everything from mortgage rates to credit cards rates higher. Everything from residential and commercial real estate to businesses will feel the pain of these higher borrowing costs. The central banks of the world have no more real options left. They've lowered the rates they control to zero, and they've flooded the system with liquidity, and their balance sheets are now swollen with these toxic assets, and outright debt monetizations will not bring the rates down. You know, with each interest rate tick higher, another green shoot dies. You know, the U.S. Treasury is facing an ordeal by fire this week as it tries to sell $100 billion of bonds to a deeply skeptical market amid growing fears of sovereign bond crisis in the Anglo-Saxon world. The interest on 10-year U.S. Treasuries, the benchmark price of long-term credit for the global system, jumped 33 basis points last week to 3.45% on contagion effects after Standard & Poor's issued a warning on Britain's AAA credit rating. The yield has risen over 90 basis points since March, when the U.S. Federal Reserve first announced its controversial plan to buy Treasury bonds directly, which itself was a move designed to force down the borrowing costs and help stabilize the housing market. The yield spike may be nearing the point now where it threatens to short-circuit economic recovery. While lower spreads of mortgage rates have kept a lid on home loan costs so far, mortgage rates have nevertheless crept back up to 5%. The Obama administration needs to raise $2 trillion this year to cover the fiscal stimulus plan and the bank bailouts. It has to fund $900 billion by September. The dynamic is just getting overwhelming. The U.S. Treasury is saying $40 billion of two-year notes on Tuesday, $35 billion of five-year bonds on Wednesday, and $25 billion of seven-year debt on Thursday. While the U.S. has not yet suffered the indignity of a failed auction, like Britain and Germany, traders are watching closely to see what share is being purchased by U.S. government in pure monetization of the deficit. Don Code, the Fed's vice chair, who I had on the show the other day answering questions in Congress, if you remember, he said over the weekend that Fed actions would add $1 trillion of stimulus to the economic recovery over time, and that he'd already prevented fire sales of assets. The preliminary evidence suggests that our program has worked, he said. This poor man. really. I don't know what he should be doing for a living. He certainly shouldn't be taking the reins of America's financial destiny in his hands. But you know, the U.S. is not alone in facing a deficit crisis. Governments worldwide have to raise some $6 trillion in debt this year, with huge demands in Europe and Japan. Kyle Bass from the U.S. fund Heyman Advisors said the markets were choking on debt. And I quote, "There isn't enough capital in the world to buy the new sovereign issuance required to finance the giant fiscal deficits that countries are so intent on running. There simply isn't enough money out there. If the U.S. loses control of wrong rates, they will not be able to arrest asset price declines. If they print too much money, they will debase the dollar and cause stagflation. The bottom line is that there is no global get-out-of-jail-free card for anyone." End of quote. Well, as I'm sure you're all aware, ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. is acutely vulnerable because it relies so heavily on foreign goodwill. China and Japan alone hold 23%, almost a quarter, of America's $6.369 billion federal debt. Actually, $6,369 billion, which I think is $6.3 trillion of federal debt. Suspicions that Washington is trying to engineer a stealth default by letting the dollar slide should cause patience to snap, even if Asian exporters would themselves suffer if they harmed their chief market. The dollar has fallen 11% against a basket of currencies since early March. Mutterings of a dollar crisis may now constrain the Fed as it tries to shore up the bond market. It has so far bought $116 billion of treasuries as part of its credit easing blitz out of a $300 billion pool. When the Fed first said it was going to buy treasuries in March, the 10-year yield dropped instantly from 3 to nearly 2.5%, but the shock effect has, of course, worn off. Any effort to step up the purchases might backfire in the current jittery move. You see, in the late 1940s, the Fed was able to cap the 10-year yield at around 2%, but that was a different world. The U.S. commanded half global GDP and had a colossal trade surplus. The Fed could carry out its experiment without worrying about foreign dissent. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has long argued that central banks can bring down long-term borrowing rates by purchasing bonds at essentially no cost. His frequent writings rarely ask whether foreign investors from a different cultural universe will tolerate such conduct. Bernanke is betting that under a floating currency regime, there is no risk of repeating the disaster of October 1931, when the Fed had to raise rates twice to stem foreign gold withdrawals, with catastrophic consequences. Well, this assumption may yet be tested. It is not clear where the capital will come from to cover global bond issues. Asian central banks and Mideast oil exporters have cut back on their purchases of U.S. and European bonds as reserve accumulation slows. Russia has slashed its holding by a third to support growth at home. Even Japan's state pension fund has become a net seller of bonds for the first time this year as the country's population ages. Japan's public debt will reach 200% of GDP next year. Warnings by the Japan DPJ opposition party that if elected this autumn it would not purchase any more U.S. debt unless issued in yen is a sign that the political mood in Asia is turning hostile to U.S. policy. There is no evidence yet that foreigners are in the process of dumping U.S. treasuries. Brad Setzer from U.S. Council on Foreign Relations said global central banks added $60 billion to their U.S. holdings in the first 3 weeks of May. This is bittersweet for Washington. It suggests that private buyers are pulling out, leaving the foreign powers as buyers of last resort. We just have to hope that the G20 creditors agree to put a clothes peg on their nose and keep buying Western debt until the crisis passes for the sake of the world. All right, let's take some mail. Let's start with Steve Canero, who wrote in on Friday, May the 22nd. And is what he said, entitled Conspiracies and Apophenia. Hi, Richard. I agree with your take on conspiracies and that some people have a need to believe in vast schemes. I think it's a form of apophenia, seeing patterns where there are none and then relating these patterns to their lives. In a strange way, I think it makes people feel less alone. I imagine you would agree that the forming of the Federal Reserve was a real-life conspiracy, in the sense that people did conspire in a secret meeting on Jekyll Island to create it. I seem to remember you mentioning that they pushed through the Federal Reserve Act on or around Christmas Eve, which is also highly suspect. Thanks, Steve. I take your point, Steve, about, you know, the difference between conspiracies and conspiracies. I think where you have specific acts like votes of Congress and organizations who are sort of planning the future of a particular event or a governmental organization shouldn't really be considered conspiracies because they're so easily verifiable. The problem with conspiracies is that they always come from an unnamed source. And people close to the action, this kind of thing. And I couldn't possibly divulge my source, this kind of thing. I mean, you know, the difference is where you really cannot verify the information you're being told. That, to me, is the kind of conspiracy that I prefer to ignore. Not because, hopefully, I'm just naive, but because usually at such times there is so much information that can be used already to define what's going on, that conspiracies tend to muddy the waters. They confuse the issue. And I have no idea what people were saying around the time of the creation of the Federal Reserve, but it certainly came up unexpectedly on the horizon, and I think it didn't take much time to create the background to the final votes in Congress. But then, you know, so was this whole question of the war in Iraq. I mean, we didn't hear about this until just pretty much days before the final plans were laid. And obviously, Bush had to have talked to the military advisors over weeks and weeks before this thing actually happened. And there is evidence to suppose that he wanted to attack Iraq with or without 9/11. So the information was there. The problem, I think, isn't so much the conspiracy. It's the lack of the desire of the media to report what is actually going on and what is actually verifiable. And we've seen this over and over again, where the media just refuses to tackle the issues. Usually, I suppose, because when they confront the powers that be, they in effect shut off communication to those powers that be in the future and anybody connected with them. So I appreciate that there is a fine line between ignoring the issues and actually taking a reasoned approach to biding one's time. But an interesting comment, and thank you very much for it, Steve. I had quite a long email from Frank Devlin, which was written actually a couple of days ago, which I will read to you because I think it's interesting. It says, Richard, the world-class spinmeisters that we refer to as government officials can neither halt nor hope us out of the coming disaster. Insolvency, unemployment, unfathomable debt, a complacently confused citizenry, and if that were not enough, the housing bubble is still with us. It is kept inflated by the government through Fannie and Freddie with our money and through the desperate spasms of the banking industry who are trying not to drown in an ocean of debt they facilitated. They are withholding 500,000 foreclosed homes from the market for fear of how little they will receive, even though their need for cash is so great. Ilagi at theautomaticearth.blogspot.com wrote a piece that brilliantly illustrates the point. And Frank quotes, in April, about 475 American homeowners per hour were served with paperwork, drawing them into one step or another of the foreclosure process. Every hour, 24 hours a day. The CS monitor envelops official data for inventory numbers and home values in a cloud of uncertainty. The paper estimates that 70% of done-deal foreclosed homes, for fear of the prices they'd fetch in an auction would be too low, are simply not put up for sale. 500,000 homes just sit there waiting for the tide to change. The report also suggests that the Obama administration exerts pressure on banks to keep them from trying to sell the properties. All this serves to prolong an unrealistically high price level as well as a hugely underestimated number of available homes. And that's still without all the owners who've simply removed the for sale signs from their lawns. One consequence is that the poor people who buy homes today pay prices that are actively, artificially, and substantially elevated by government policies. First through Fannie and Freddie's mortgage purchases, second through these don't ask, don't tell foreclosure policies. A government that tricks its own citizens into greatly overpaying for what is likely the most costly purchase in their lives is truly quite something from an ethics and morality point of view. But everybody's silent on the topic. Nobody dares touch that scary real world out there. It would be enormously useful if an economist such as Robert Shiller would crunch his present numbers against a background in which banks were to try to sell all their REO, real estate owned, confiscated properties as fast as they could, and in which Freddie and Fannie would not be there to catch their fall. That would provide a far more accurate picture of a more or less free market, and it would save today's home buyers tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars on their purchases and monthly mortgage payments, provided they were able to get a loan, that is. The reason the Obama administration engages in these ethically highly questionable, if not outright illegal slash criminal politics, is identical to why it does just about everything, saving Wall Street. Indices such as the S&P Case-Shiller, one published today, would show hugely lower price levels if all repossessed homes were put on the market. The banks that own them need money badly and live on only thanks to your bailout money. And if the taxpayer would no longer be forced to finance his neighbor's home purchase through Freddie and Fannie. These lower price levels, in turn, would force much more write-downs on losses for Wall Street banks at a time when they want to use them least of all. Losses on mortgages, on mortgage-backed securities, and likely also on swaps and other derivatives, though that is murky OTC territory. Keeping home prices artificially high keeps Wall Street alive, literally. As long as Obama and Geithner continue to play these games, sure, consumer confidence may rise a bit, especially since they also hold a 3.5% GDP growth in the fall carrot in front of their voters' faces. But this has to stop somewhere. There are almost 2 million homes in foreclosure, 500,000 that have been foreclosed but not for sale, and millions more that either takes ages to sell, if at all, or are taken off the market by discouraged owners. Yes, it saves individuals, corporations, and society at large from facing the truth for a short period of time, but at the same moment, scores of homes are added to the unsold inventory all the time, day after day. It leads to a society with an increasingly grossly distorted view of where it's at any given point in time, just so present divisions of power and money can be sustained or increased an X number of weeks or months longer. If only because of the homes that will inevitably be added through job losses, option ARM and Alt-A resets and other factors, there will soon come a time when the lies must necessarily be exposed. That is when the real price will be paid, and by then a huge additional part of that price will have been transferred to those who can least afford to pay. That is the process that's going on right now, and it's just plain wrong in my book. Better to shatter your hopes and beliefs now than to see your entire lives shattered later. Obfuscation, fraud, theft, illusion, false hope, and all those 900-pound gorillas, still a large number of our citizens are looking for green shoots. We are doomed to be hung by the petard of our own fantasies. In reference to your impending move, it has been said that timing is everything. Your timing, Richard, seems to be very prescient. As always, thank you for reminding us to think rationally and for attempting educational CPR to save our foundering financial lives. From the foxhole, Frank. Well, thank you, Frank. Very, very prescient, I would say. Pertinent information. Well, we have another little screed that came in today, Frank. I'll see if I can get to it a little bit later. There is a theme that I've been hammering on for some time, which is the direct correlation between the loss of jobs and the increase in foreclosures, which, of course, in turn adds further stress to the bank's already ugly balance sheets. As the New York Times notes, the number of prime mortgages that were delinquent at least 90 days were in foreclosure or had deteriorated to the point that the lender took possession of the home jumped enormously as job loss accelerated. Of the period when the BLS was reporting 500,000 plus jobs a month from November 2008 to February 2009, the numbers of distressed properties increased more than 470,000, exceeding 1.5 million. And the total loan value, by the way, is more than $224 billion. So even if the recession did end tomorrow, the U.S. would still have another 500,000 to 1 million foreclosures. And if the recession continues for another 6 months to a year, well, you do the math. In the latest phase of the nation's real estate disaster, the locus of trouble has shifted from subprime loans, which are those extended to buyers with troubled credit, to the far more numerous prime loans issued to those with decent financial histories. With many economists anticipating that the unemployment rate will rise into the double digits from its current 8.9%, foreclosures are obviously going to accelerate. And that in turn will exacerbate bank losses, adding pressure to the financial system and the broader economy. Economists refer to the current surge of foreclosures as the third wave, distinct from the initial spike when speculators gave up property because of plunging real estate prices and the secondary shock when borrowers' introductory rates expired and were reset higher. Note that these foreclosures are not the exotic no money down from the early phase of the housing collapse. These are the modest borrowers whose loans did fit their income. And a few data points one might consider from February 2009. Foreclosure rates among prime borrowers have been growing fastest in states with higher unemployment. Economy.com expects mortgage defaults in 2009 caused by employment to double from 29% in 2008 to 60% in 2009. Prime mortgages that are distressed, that's to say 90 days delinquent, foreclosure, REO, are greater than 1.5 million. Alt-A loans, which are those given to people with slightly tainted credit, rose to 836,000. The subprime mortgages themselves that were distressed reached 1.65 million. From February 2008 to February 2009, the total dollar value of distressed mortgages increased 60% in dollar terms. More than 4 million loans worth $717 billion were distressed in February. Well, all told, there's about 4 million problem mortgages out there. And my guess is that half of those will go into foreclosure. So far, the Obama administration aid to homeowners has seen less than 55,000 mortgages modified. So what this means, if there's anybody out there who's still following on these statistics, is that we will see lower real estate prices, more bank stress, a lot more distressed sales, and no normalization of the real estate markets for a long time. The best you can hope for is what they call stabilization. If you consider 60% of all existing home sales and many new home sales to be distressed sales, foreclosures or bank-owned properties as stable. All right. Al Berry wrote in on Monday, and he said, I'll have to come back to that one. Thomas Russell wrote in and said, "Hi, Richard, long-time listener, first-time emailer." Sounds like Tom Likas in Los Angeles. "I enjoy your insight on current affairs. Could you explain to your listeners the steps that an expatriate would need to take to avoid continued taxation by Uncle Sam? This seems to be a deal-breaker for most. My ancestors left the U.S. over 200 years ago when procedures were very simple, no tax treaties or tracking. Thank you, Thomas Russell in Canada." Thomas, I am not an expatriate. I am actually going to be an ex-permanent resident. Not quite the same thing, but actually in many ways similar, because as a permanent resident or a green card holder of the United States, if you leave the United States and you remain under permanent resident status, you are liable to Uncle Sam for the next 10 years. Now, that's just if you are a permanent resident. If you are a citizen of the United States, which is what I take it to mean that you mean by an expatriate, then you will have to either renounce your citizenship or just disappear, because you will be liable to tax for the rest of your born days wherever you live on the face of the earth. And by the way, the United States is the only country that taxes its non-resident citizens. So there's really little you can do. Now, although you're writing from Canada, Thomas, I assume that you are actually American, because you talk as an American, but unfortunately, other than for renouncing citizenship, you will be liable for your taxes forever. In a sense, it is a deal breaker, and I fully understand that, because in addition to leaving the country, if you actually had to renounce your citizenship, that really is more than most people are prepared to do. So, anyway, that's hopefully the answer to that question. I got a rather strange email from Michael Reidinger, which I think I will read. Maybe some of you can make out the import of this. I was kind of nonplussed, as I think they say, or somewhat confused. But anyway, let me read it. It's only about 15 lines long. "Hello, friends. Michael Reidinger here, sharing some great news and opinion. As some of you know, I have been tying sacred prayer necklaces called malas that originated from India. A mala most likely inspired the creation of the rosary used in the Catholic Church throughout the world. Malas have been very popular recently as the yoga movement has grown. Inspired by the Love Daily malas created by Alison Stillman and son Justice Doherty, and compelled to fill the void they left, I have carried on the spirit of these beautiful creations and have been very busy tying and getting them into people's hands. Well, friends, this June editions of the Yoga Journal magazine, distributed nationally, features a female model, Himalaya, a good friend and neighbor, wearing a custom Ojai mala. It is made of amethyst, rose quartz, labradorite, and black pearl. Hey, Dad, that geology, marketing degree, finally paid off 16 years later. Just wanted to share the joy of this 15 minutes and say blessings and thanks to all of you who walked with me on the path that led us to now. Thank you again, and you know who you are. Thanks and aho to the masters, devis, gurus, and beloveds that inspire me. Namaste, Michael Reidinger, also known as Ganji. P.S. Don't forget to take a peek at the No Frills website, www.ohaimalas.com. And for those of you who are interested, Ojaimalas is spelled Ojaimalas. Well, Michael, thank you very much for that edifying email. I haven't received one like that before, so now we all know what you do in your spare time. Very, very good. I had a rather disappointing and frustrating email from Tony McConnell, who wanted me to share the outrage of this situation where the 401ks refused to offer the Treasury money market funds. So he, I'll read out the relevant bits from it here, and he says, "Dear Richard, I do hope everything is going well for you with the move and all. I have a couple of questions for you. First is, I got a really lame excuse of an email from our 401k plan administrators re-getting a Treasury bill fund attached at the bottom of this email. Please share with your listeners if you feel it's relevant. Seems to me that they're perfectly happy to lose 4% of my cash, and I'm supposed to think that's a good deal. Well, the situation reversed and I lifted 40 cents from them every time they stood in line with me at the lunch counter, I think I'd soon get into an altercation. So why is it okay for them, but if I did it, I'd get arrested? Nobody ever said life was fair, I grant you, but we really all are being taken to suckers here. Anyway, nothing but praise and adulations for the wake-up call as ever. Anyone who sends an email at 4 a.m. on a Saturday morning on Britney's take on the economy really does have every base covered." Okay, so let me read the email that Tony received from what appears to be the administrator of the 401k options. And, of course, the ignorance of this email, it shatters the mind. But the fact that the person was actually able to write this in the first place is of some import. So I'm going to read it to you. "Tony, I apologize again for the delay in getting back to you on this, but I finally have some information from Rogers Financial. They did some further research on this and a few issues came up. Apparently, the Treasury bill's money market funds require a more advanced, robust record-keeping system than Wachovia currently has." Yeah, really. A fund with a net asset value of $1 that never changes must need a tremendous amount of record keeping. I agree with you here. "There is a possibility that the merger with Wells Fargo will allow for the record keeping improvements, but that has yet to be determined. So until the reorganization has been completed, they are simply not in a position to offer any Treasury bill money market funds. In addition, Rogers says also that most Treasury bill money market funds are actually closed to new investors right now. I don't understand the fine points, but apparently their value has deteriorated to such an extent that the funds simply won't accept any new investors." That is completely, well, apart from the fact that it's a lie, it's unintelligible, because how could a Treasury bill money market fund's value deteriorate? If anybody's got any ideas on that, please call. We actually have a call from Bill from San Diego. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Mr. Martin. Yeah, I was listening earlier and then looking at the way the 10-year Treasury bond has been going up in price.
Going down in price, but up in interest rate, correct?
Yeah. Is there a way we can profit from that, or are we just supposed to stay out of it and keep in our short-term T-bills, or what's your advice?
My advice is to do nothing. My advice is to wait until the moment comes to buy these bonds at very advantageous prices in front of what I think will be a massive rally in Treasury bonds, making new all-time highs. In other words, new all-time lows in interest rates. That is what I think is going to happen in the future. But I fear that it's too early to go into this and to try to profit from this situation right now. I don't think that you do yourself a favor by buying bonds at these levels. It will come up to an excellent buy at some point, and I will try and identify that point or around it, and we will do something about that. But right now, I wouldn't try particularly to take advantage of it. Some people have called me and asked me about the stock TBT, which is an exchange-traded fund which goes up as the price of bonds goes down, and they've done very well with that stock in recent weeks and probably will continue to do well. But, I don't really talk to speculators too much here. I tend to want to talk to a larger run of people who are trying to protect their money, and so probably, unless you really know what you're doing, you won't want to go for that. But I assure you that when the time comes, Bill, you're going to make a tremendous amount of money. I mean, if you do decide to buy bonds in the form of, say, zero coupon government bonds at a time when bond prices rise, you'll do very, very well. So that will be my answer to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you for calling. Okay, let me just finish off this crazy email from a person called Jamie at Tony's 401k provider. Says, Rogers, and Rogers again is Rogers Financial, who are apparently the brokers to the 401k plan. Rogers also thought it was important to point out that the Wachovia Stable Value Fund, remember that, ladies and gentlemen, those bugbears that we've discussed? The Wachovia Stable Value Fund contains insurance wrappers, which means that if for some reason Wachovia had to liquidate their funds, participants would be guaranteed to receive at least 96 cents on the dollar for their funds. So while we continue to monitor the situation, we do feel that, all things considered, the funds are in pretty safe hands right now. I hope that helps, Jamie. Well, the one thing Jamie didn't tell you was who it is that's guaranteeing $96 on the dollar, 96 cents on the dollar for these funds. Who's the guarantor? They don't say. Because he doesn't want to admit that it's actually the insurance companies themselves. In fact, there is a state form of guarantee behind it, but look at the state the states are in these days. 47% of all states now are underwater. They're in a severe debt situation, led by California. Ladies and gentlemen, do you want to throw your lot in with these states, dependent on them to rescue your 401k? I don't think so. It's too bad. It really is. I thought that actually Tony's letter to the plan was very good. That he wrote before, in response to which I just read you the letter from this Jamie. I'm going to read it to you because this is something you might want to consider writing, ladies and gentlemen, something in this tone, in this vein, if you really want to question the validity of your 401k minimum risk investments. He writes, I chose the stable value fund from our 401k options fund some time ago as I felt exposure to the stock market was a bad idea. Stable value funds are supposed to be a safe place to put money, but this no longer appears to be the case. According to the breakdown sent by Rogers Financial a week or so ago, our 401k stable value has approximately 25% cash. Okay with that. Now, 20% government agency and treasury. What does that mean? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were government agencies in which people invested, and look at them. 3.6% guaranteed investment contracts. As I gather, it's a form of insurance. No major issue with this except for the fact that insurance companies are going bankrupt. 10% mortgage securities. Enough said. Who in their right mind would hold those? 11.9% commercial mortgage-backed securities. These are next in line for oblivion. Look at the commercial bankruptcies we've seen of late. What about Circuit City, Expo, etc., vacating the malls? 13.3% asset-backed securities. What kind of so-called assets are these? 8.4% corporate securities. Great to see how well all these corporations are doing, isn't it? Jamie, I don't mean to be flippant. I just want to stress that I'm not looking at this from a position of panic, but I'm logically evaluating the holdings of the fund. I see 25% stability, cash, and 75% risk for what should be a fund without market exposure. You will see in the attached articles that, far from being a cash-only vehicle, these funds are exposed to insurance risk and are an unsafe, conservative vehicle for preservation of capital. The only true safe haven at this moment would be a Treasury bill money market. I am writing to you to request that PSI require, underlined, that Wachovia give us the option of a money market fund based solely on Treasury bills. Not bonds, not money market with commercial paper, but uniquely Treasury bills. This can be done at virtually no cost to them and would be a very simple matter. I think there are many PSI employees who would welcome such a fund. I would be glad to write a registered letter to our plan supervisor. However, I thought the request might be best coming from PSI Corporate. Thanks for your attention. Regards, Tony. Well, congratulations, Tony. That's a really great letter. I can't believe the response that I read earlier on is a response to that letter. It has absolutely nothing to do with it. It doesn't address any of the issues. They just don't care. And the sad part about it is that you won't have any redress if this thing does go belly up, if your stable value fund. There's nothing you can do. I don't think there's anything you can do, but I'd like to see, at least you have a paper trail of what you sent and what was sent back. Hopefully, well, obviously, this Jamie received your email because he or she replies to it and references it, so they can't pretend they didn't get it. But who is going to take responsibility? That's the million-dollar question here. Because I can assure you that the corporations won't, the plan administrator won't, and the broker won't. So I don't really see much left under the circumstances. I don't know what else you can possibly do. Well, I think we'll finish with Frank's other rant here. It's rather good. He wrote it actually today, earlier this morning. It's called State of Affairs, and it says this. Richard, as you said the other day about the writings of Bill Bonner, his comment said it so well, you would just read his post. In the same vein, I offer you a quick snapshot of our current situation and how it fundamentally affects us as written Ilaji of theautomaticearth.blogspot.com. In my opinion, few say it better or probe the root causes of this disaster with such skill. As you have mentioned on Wake Up Call, there is a societal cost to all this loss. Money is at its root a means of survival. It isn't just an economic issue when people lose their home, it is one of survival. Our view of society is so skewed that we are only thinking about the survival of banks, not people. I'm quoting from Ilaji. Although it's under threat of being swamped by tons and tons of rotting shoots, the most interesting number today, for me, probably comes from Dean Baker, who has this statement about real estate in U.S. Housing equity continues to be destroyed at the rate of $400 billion a month. What intrigues me about this, of course, is how it rhymes with Nouria Roubini, Paul Kasriel, Henry Blodgett, plus a whole slew of anonymous economists hired by a spin bureau with great media access, who all came out today proclaiming recovery is here, or at least it'll be here before the end of the year. If U.S. homeowners, who also double as consumers, and as such bear responsibility for over 70% of U.S. GDP, lose $1,333 per capita every month, or 15.996 per year, or 63,000, I think that is, 63,984 per nuclear family, where for all the mothers of all the prophets in history or so, I wonder, will that recovery originate? Now, I know a man cannot live by home or homemade bread alone, but there is more to the economy than just real estate and mortgages. But if on average a family needs to earn over $60,000 just in order to not fall even deeper into the debt trap, while at the same time every single month over 600,000 jobs are lost that are crucially needed to pay for just that play-even scenario, I'm starting to have serious questions about that recovery. Come to think of it, and while we're at it, I also get serious doubts as to the reasons why these folks say these things to begin with. It makes no sense to me. That much is clear. Why are we still listening to these people? All they do is just erase from the field all considerations concerning anything serious. Economics is politics, and economists merely function to justify whatever political model they happen to serve in their respective nations and regimes. We are in the middle of a crisis. We are being eaten up alive by an all-out encompassing societal crisis. It's not about money. It's about you, your families, friends, and ultimately about survival. Forget about recovery. You'll never get back to what you once had. And knowing that and accepting that, it's time to celebrate life as it will be, to make the best of what is, not of what was or could have been. Smoking green shoots doesn't seem to me to be the best way to do that. What we are in is not something we would ever have chosen, but here we are. And for once, it's accurate to say that nothing will ever be the same. There's no way back, no recovery. And we're going to have the work, the land, real long and real hard before it rewards us with anything green. From the foxhole, Frank. No green shoots here. Well, thank you, Frank. I'm afraid we had to edit that a little bit because we're out of time, but it was edifying nevertheless. Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful weekend. This is Richard Marting, back with you again, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday. Take care. Bye-bye.